Welcome to Discursion Episode 3. I'm Stephen.
And I'm Dominic.
And this week we're talking about Phantom Thread.
Yeah, Paul Thomas Anderson's 2017 film. We should probably say we're not going to even attempt to avoid spoilers, I don't think.
No.
So, you know, listen away now if you haven't already seen the film. But we should do some sort of plot introduction at least.
Yeah, sure. Do you want me to do that?
Or
you
go ahead.
Can do that? Usually, I mean, I can do that and then you can correct me if I've...
I'll keep an eye out for any inaccuracies.
Yeah, okay, so where are we? Mid-1950s, London, couture, fashion, culture, and Reynolds Woodcock is designing a dress for a countess.
Hmm.
So that's over the course of the film. But while designing dresses, he also meets Alma, and they fall in love. We later learn that Reynolds has had a sort of series of loves and start to wonder that whether Alma might just be another sort of disposable
character. I mean, in fact, I think we know that at the very beginning. I'll step in it, because I think one of the early people that we see is another of his live-in lovers, and she's sort of complaining to Reynolds that he doesn't seem to have much interest in her anymore.
So already wrong-footing the romance.
Yeah, there are a number of films that I suppose have the theme of a womanizing, or at least a kind of serial, a man with not terribly profound serial relationships then finds the woman who changes things, or not. I mean, this film is extremely different, but actually Written on the Wind has that kind of structure, because yeah, Robert Stack's character just wants to kind of pick up Lauren Bacall as kind of just another one in the series, and then she won't be that. So yeah,
because at first things seem to be quite genuine and sincere, and there seems to be a genuine attraction between the two characters. It's only later on that things really start to sour, and the question is raised by Cyril, Reynolds' sister. You know, are we going to kick her out?
Yes, we should mention obviously. Yeah, Reynolds, Daniel Day-Lewis in what supposedly is going to be his final film performance. Alma Vicky Creeps, who the only other thing I've seen her in is she has a tiny role. Have you seen Hannah, that Joe Wright kind of, what is it, some sort of action thriller with...
is this the sort of survival thriller?
Exactly.
And there's the young girl...
Yeah, Saoirse Ronan is the young girl who's been...
I have seen it.
It's kind of super spy thing. Yeah. Well, her mother is Vicky Creeps, she's barely in it at all. And that's the only other thing I think I've seen her in. And then Cyril Leslie Manville. I mean, would you say this film is... Seems to me that this is a film which really changes quite substantially on a second or a subsequent viewing from... Yeah, as opposed to how it comes across in the first viewing, because so many things only become clear once the plot has entirely unfolded and the characters have done everything that they've done. And so, I mean, relating to these things you just said, exactly about how vulnerable is Alma, or isn't she, and finding that she likes Reynolds more when he's vulnerable and needs her. And so she deliberately poisons him with mushrooms so that he's ill, and so she can nurse him back to health, which works the first time, after which they get married. And then later on, when the marriage doesn't seem to have changed their relationship, she does it again, but this time he cottons on to what's going on and so sort of enters into it,
you know,
willingly. Which, I've read interviews or heard interviews with Paul Thomas Anderson, who apparently that was actually the kernel of the film. I mean, he talked about being nursed when he was poorly, and his wife was kind of nursing him. I mean, she hadn't poisoned him with mushrooms or with anything else, as far as I'm aware. But that he got this sense that she's actually quite enjoying this. She's enjoying this sort of having this nurturing role, but also having this power over me. So that apparently was sort of where the narrative grew out of. But definitely the first time you see the film, or I saw the film, that's not a place I was expecting it to go in any way.
So there are games and rituals that you notice the second time round, including the sort of master-servant dynamic. You can make some comparisons maybe with Joseph Losey's He's the Servant. There's a similar switch of in the power balance there in the second half. More abrupt than in this film, perhaps, but both abrupt, where Dirk Bogarde suddenly takes control, you know, having been the butler character. And the second half becomes the master. So, and there are other rituals as well that you might not fully engage with the first time round, like the superstition. The so Reynolds is a very superstitious character. Just to mention one of the details that you might not have noticed the first time around, when he's eating the asparagus, I'm pretty sure he throws salt over his shoulder, which, if I'm not mistaken, is to ward off an evil presence, or it's some kind of good luck.
I thought one was supposed to throw
gesture, is it?
I thought you were supposed to throw salt over your shoulder if you spill the salt, but we don't see him spill it, so I'm not sure if there are other. But clearly, it's some absolutely, it's some form of superstition. When this the film is kind of well, it's a broadly, I suppose, realistic drama, and yet that doesn't seem quite right because it hints at all sorts of other things, or it draws on. I mean, it's called Phantom Thread. There's lots of references to ghosts. I mean, there is one explicit scene where Reynolds kind of hallucinates his mother's ghost. This kind of hovering threat and uncertainty, which is, I think, throughout the film, and I think I felt particularly strongly the first time round because one doesn't know where it's going. The film of PTAs that it seems closest to me, or closest to in general, but in this regard as well, is The Master.
Yes.
Which I felt a similar kind of constant threat, even though nothing terrible happens, and nothing, you know, nothing violent happens in this film either, but there's just, you don't know whether, I mean, in The Master it's sort of perhaps more about whether Joaquin Phoenix's character will kind of explode.
But I agree with you, yeah. I think it has the similar sort of cult of personality that you find in The Master, with that intense relationship between Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman. I'm also going to throw a spanner in the works and say it reminds me of Punch Drunk Love. In that Adam Sandler, you know, has these outbursts. He is surrounded by his sisters who constantly tease him. Incidentally, Philip Seymour Hoffman is also in that film.
Has
his outburst, but is outbursted by Adam Sandler.
Well, it's also like that in the Emily Watson's character, and that seems to be the straight man, as it were, to, you know, Adam Sandler's kind of kooky off the wall character. But in fact, there are a number of hints that she's, or and more explicit indications that she, that perhaps been underestimating her. I mean, there's a thing which I really like this that Mark Kermode pointed out in those series he just did for the BBC. Did you see any of the?
I did see those.
The one on the rom-com. He pointed out that in fact there is a figure. Because, you know, whereas Adam Sandler's character is always in his blue sort of suit, and Emily Watson's often in this red, isn't she? And there's a scene in the supermarket early on when there's a red figure very much out of focus in the background who seems to be following Adam Sandler along the aisle. So there's just there are explicit things in the dialogue later on that she's kind of pestering Adam Sandler's sisters to get introduced to him. And yeah, depending on which characters you focus on, I think it changes quite a lot. Or yes, and there's a risk of underestimating the characters if we assume that it's a film about a self-indulgent, powerful man.
It is. It is another portrayal of a very creative and powerful man, isn't it? But it does. It's what it does with that.
Well, it's also who are the protagonists? Because I think the protagonist is not even. That okay, it's not just Reynolds, it's also Alma, but it's Reynolds and Alma and Cyril.
Yeah,
I think I would say, I mean, this is again something I've heard Paul Thomas Anderson say, which is not necessarily, if the director says it, that doesn't necessarily, you know, kind of valid. Well, apparently,
really?
So apparently, it's possible to disagree
questioning
with
the director.
But he talks about this, he talks about how, well, if you have a Daniel Day-Lewis film, you can't not put his name in the most lights or highest on the, but he talks about is really is it being about Alma and Cyril, And that structure of three is of course nice because you get, I think you get through the film all the different combinations of 2+1 in various ways, often in quite subtle ways.
Yeah.
All three of them, yeah, or every possible pair kind of gangs up against one of the other or is on the same side against one of the others at some point.
And thinking about the arithmetic of the film and how that works aesthetically, they all get single shots, quite powerful singles.
Yes.
Which gives them even weight, at least in a stylistic kind of sense. So there's some wonderful shots of Cyril sort of sat at her desk. If you watch the sort of camera outtakes as well, Paul Thomas Anderson notes that they had a very garish wallpaper behind Cyril's desk, which sort of drew attention away from Cyril, as well as not really being in keeping with her character. So instead they went for a sort of dark navy blue. So he has thought about how he's going to frame these characters as individuals.
Yes. And even the more minor character, I mean, not obviously not every single one, but some of the alcoholic rich American woman who has a dress made for her. Because there's a scene in which after she's passed out at her own wedding, but still wearing the dress, and they're horrified at this, and so go and, you know, tear the dress off her. Well, not tear, because of course, very much not tear the dress.
No.
Extremely carefully remove the dress from her, and they're horrified that Alma has a line about she can behave how she likes, but not while being dressed by the House of Woodcock. There is a comedy in that sequence, and a sort of extremity which is kind of comic. But there's also, in the context of a sort of earlier scenes where you've seen this woman obviously have quite a lot of self-loathing, which is, you know, she thinks she's ugly, and this is obviously connected to the alcohol. And there's a press conference with her husband where he claims that he's not marrying her for her money because he has plenty of his own, which I assume we're to take as you know, ironic.
Yes.
So there's a lot of this character who could be a caricature is also given quite a lot of, you know, a certain degree of kind of tenderness and some level of, you know, respect by the film, I feel.
That's another part of the kind of superstructure, or just the broader themes that the film deals with, along with superstition. Is the changing of the times,
yes,
fashion culture.
Yes.
Towards the end of the film, he's losing his will to live. And it seems that in one of those 2+1 scenarios, Alma and Cyril are together, whereas and you know, Reynolds has been left out in the cold. And alongside that, you have this coming of chic fashion, which Reynolds has to try to, maybe he won't adapt to it, but he has to try and compete in that market now.
Yes. But he doesn't want to have to. I mean, his inability to change or to deal with the unexpected is a very important thread that runs through all sorts of particular.
He's bloody stubborn, isn't he?
Exactly. But that's possibly a change that, yeah, I think this is something which Alma has little patience for right from the beginning. Whereas Cyril possibly actually is occasioned to have to change her attitude. Cyril explains that, you know, he needs things to be a certain way. And then later on, there's a crucial scene when Alma wants to surprise Reynolds with a dinner for the two of them. And Cyril says this won't work. But Alma insists, and Cyril turns out to be entirely right. But then later on, you have scenes where Cyril is just as irritated with Reynolds' indulgences as Alma was. But whether that's a case of, through Alma's example, Cyril has come to not indulge her brother in the way she has, or whether the earlier scenes are in fact more her exerting her power over Alma. And in fact, there's almost nothing in this film which simply works on one note, on one way to make one point in it. You know, I feel there's always, you know, at least a couple of layers of character or a couple of ways of approaching motivations. But yeah, so the food and appetite, it doesn't simply, you know, doesn't do anything as crude as simply standing for sex or anything else, but it obviously is very much tied up with that. But it's also about creativity because Reynolds is, he's hungry when he's feeling fulfilled and creative. I mean, he's literally hungry. He eats lots of food. I mean, there's another morning, isn't there, where he tells the housekeeper to make a huge breakfast, and I think that's after, yes, you know, he and Alma have slept together for the first time, and he feels that she's very much on his side because she's been sort of fighting for his dresses, as we mentioned before, and that's another point at which he gets hungry. And then at the very end of the film, when he's, you know, he's been poisoned for the second time, and isn't the last line in the film is, "I'm getting hungry."
Yeah.
But we're led to believe, I suppose, that it's what's been set up is some kind of cycle, isn't it? It's not that they've now got, so it's not happily ever after in the sense that they've now got their relationship into a state where it will be unproblematic from now on. It's that it's at that stage when the film ends, but then it's presumably going to go south again, and he'll,
yeah, they've developed a routine to cope with his routines. A counter routine.
Yes, to break his yes, precisely, and to make him, I suppose, so part of Reynolds' sort of vanity is precisely that he thinks he understands himself terribly well, and so in part of, in fact, what he loves in Alma is he comes to realise that she does actually understand him better than he does himself.
There's a character in Agnes Varda's film Happiness he's polyamorous, and he's trying to convince his wife that he's had an affair, but it's okay, he just couldn't help himself. And throughout the film we're shown that he literally can't help himself. He takes things, including food, and he'll just, you know, tear off someone walking past with a piece of bread, and he'll just tear off and he'll eat that. And throughout this film, Reynolds is having to eat to kind of drive his creativity and also his sort of just general lust, his kind of fullness. And so, you know, and the language as well has a kind of nice materiality to it as well, when he's ordering porridge and sausage.
Listing.
And he dwells,
yes,
on those words. Yes. And so all of that is very charged by the time we get to the act of eating the omelette. I don't want to sound abstract about it, because it is a very simple thing, but his the way he eats the omelette.
Yes.
Is very well done. It's some of the finest omelette eating I've seen in cinema.
Well, it's brilliantly done.
Just like the lovely hallway shots, some of the finest hallway shots I've seen in.
Yes, yes. Well, of course, yes, and yeah, there's no cinematographer credited, because Paul Thomas Anderson, I mean, he has a
lighting camera.
Lighting cameraman credited and
collaborated with.
And camera operators, but he did lots of the cinematography himself.
Michael Bauman, who also worked on Radiohead's Daydreaming music video, and The Master as chief lighting technician.
Which links with Johnny Greenwood's score, which we haven't mentioned. Yeah, there's lots of music. There's a certain sense in which this is a... is this an old-fashioned film? In some ways not, but in other ways...
Aesthetically, it tries to be. They used vintage lenses, and they used a special processing for the film, which means the grain is kind of emphasised, and that gives it a lovely kind of 50s feel.
But the colours don't look like a 50s film, though. I mean, the stock is very different.
The colours are interesting, because there's a play with light there, so you have the coldness of the light in the House of Woodcock contrasted constantly with the warm recuperation scenes.
Yes,
so there's the austerity versus the kind of warmth and that kind of family feel. I'm not sure I go far as to say family feel, but you know what I mean.
Yes.
So it's more about light than I think
yeah.
it is colour. Although there are some choice colours for the dresses.
Yes. Would you say some connection to sort of, I don't know, Powell and Pressburger or something?
I don't know, because with Powell and Pressburger, that if you're thinking about colour, thinking about saturated colour.
Yeah, I didn't really mean the colour. I just meant the in terms of, you know, if it feels like it's, because I definitely don't feel it's It's not a pastiche of any particular sort of older form of filmmaking, which I know. I mean, I think I don't think it could have been made at any time except in the last however many years.
No.
But it is also clearly something, at least superficially, sort of classical about it.
Well, it feels like it's aged. I mean, the film has literally been processed for longer than it normally is. It reminds me more of The Master in the way in which it's not referencing really earlier cinema. It's just trying to capture a period without doing it in the kind of televisual, pristine historical.
It does have these echoes. I mean, other things we mentioned, sort of ghost stories, other things. I mean, there's also the sort of, you know, Rebecca kind of structure. I think that's
level of narrative
floating around in there somewhere. I mean, it makes things very rich, but again, the risk would just be that you come out going, well, that was interesting, but I'd rather go and watch Rebecca, or, you know, that just it's a risky thing to invite, you know, comparison.
Yeah.
But this manages to be, I think for me, it's because it manages to be its own thing. It manages to, appropriately with the food themes, it's digested its ingredients.
Yeah. Gothic gastronomy.
Or at least
I'm using too many big words this episode.
No, I like it. The dresses, I mean, I know nothing about fashion or dressmaking, and certainly not in the 50s, but we're not at any point. But they seem to me to have struck, the balance is really interesting, because the dresses are quite attractive, but they're also old fashioned and they don't look terribly comfortable. I don't think they're elegant, but I mean, in fact, there's even a shot sort of very early in the film, in the first dress fitting, which you see the woman's back being kind of pulled in by them closing the sort of corset.
I wonder if stiffness
defines
the aesthetic of the film.
But it just seems that so in the actual costume design, it seems really interestingly poised, because it would be easy for the film to either come down on Reynolds' side as an example of, you know, a more elegant, a more skillful, a form of craft which is dying, or to place him more clearly as someone who is a kind of a dinosaur who can't realise that his time has gone. But in terms of, and I mean, in a sense, I suppose, kind of personally, that's true. But in terms of the actual art that he makes, the actual dresses you see in the film, they seem to sort of do both.
Yeah.
Which, again, I think is quite an achievement.
Yeah. It was the only Oscar that... The film was nominated for, I think, 6 or 7 Oscars, but this, the only one it won was for costume design, Mark Bridges.
Sad. I mean, very well-deserved, but sadly predictable.
Sure.
You know, you make a film about a costume designer and then it gets, you know, it's critically well-received.
Or you make a historical drama, sorry to interrupt, and it gets
costume. Let's give him costume design.
Yeah. And when it's precisely not, it's like it's not that kind of historical drama.
No.
You know.
No, I mean, that's another thing that it does, in terms of the history, there are these sort of, because Alma is, we're not quite sure where she's from. She could be German, she could be Dutch, she could be, and not, but she's sort of middle European, and there are things about that, but again, they're underplayed. She doesn't say much about her parents. She's asked about her mother and she doesn't say much about her. But then there's reference to the husband of the American heiress having sold passports to Jews. So
that's really interesting detail.
So there's something in there. And is Alma possibly Jewish? It's not ruled out. And then later there's some sort of fairly casual, I mean, it's not anti-Semitic, or not, I don't think it's coded as such, but another friend of Reynolds, who's, I'm not exactly sure what she is, but she's some sort of aristocrat, but she just makes generally sort of xenophobic remarks about
is she
about,
what is she doing? Is she attacking people or stealing things?
Yes, exactly.
That's the assertion. Alma is,
you know, what do they, and when Reynolds and Alma have their big fight after Alma has, you know, surprised him with a romantic dinner, which he describes as an ambush. He tells her to, you know, fuck off back to where she comes from or something.
Yeah.
So
Yeah, I don't know if that's Paul Thomas Anderson maybe responding to some more recent political events, you know, anti-immigration, those kinds of sentiments you see in American and UK politics. Perhaps.
Yeah.
Or maybe, just, maybe not.
And just his place in the film. One could, I suppose, make a case and say, okay, so it's not... It's a film that doesn't really care about politics, but kind of puts in a little bit of lip service to pretend that it does. Little hints. But I feel that would be unfair as a charge, but I'm not quite sure how I...
No, I know. I just wonder if it's sort of seeped into the kind of pause of the film.
How would you... If someone made that kind of accusation, how would you defend the film?
Well, I suppose one argument would be that these... If you want to go down that road, that these political sentiments are often are hidden away, and they are sort of under the surface, and that beneath this kind of straight-laced, you know, pseudo-aristocratic world, there are deep channels of
yes.
racism and xenophobia that do surface occasionally, but are not not present all the time. Why? Well, because. They want to maintain some kind of civility in conversation, which is a hypocritical thing. So it's dwelling on the hypocrisy of that.
Yes, it would misrepresent the way these things just run underneath as undercurrents. And it would be a shame to have to argue that any politics in a film has to always be unambiguous and in your face and insisted upon, because then that would seem to imply that you can only have either films whose whole purpose is to be political, or films which are not political in any sense at all, which would not be a very satisfactory solution, I don't think.
No, but I'm not sure it is a very point-making, finger-wagging film. The film is patterned with these confrontations that occur within this very tightly kind of regimented lifestyle, which repeats and repeats and repeats.
Yes.
The character that kind of pulls it forward and that introduces change is Alma, and to some extent Reynolds responds to the change. But she's an outside figure. You know, she's a disruption to the
As we said, she's the one from
to the routine,
not from England, but she's also she's explicitly the sort of foreign element that's come into the house, like Joan Fontaine in Rebecca.
Yeah.
They haven't really talked about the script particularly, but there are a number of nice moments where the script is kind of somewhat flat. I think it's an excellent script, but it's not a script with a capital script.
No.
That asks you to admire its cleverness, and they're often, particularly when there are fights, and I think it's a particularly nice example when Alma and Reynolds have the fight after she's cooked him dinner, and she's kind of trying to do a rhetorical kind of raising of the temperature, and ends up just kind of going because she, you know, can't think of anything more to say, which is
it's quite a Spartan
which
script.
Is very persuasive. I think that there's quite a lot of times where characters have situations where you feel the character would want to say something which would be a great line if their life was a film, and the film just holds back from giving them. It gives them a good line, but it very much also relies on the delivery rather than kind of giving them an excellently crafted kind of literary line that'll go in the book of great film lines. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of swallowed lines. In other words, there is a literal holding back, but on the part of the characters in the film as well. So there is a moment where Cyril is pondering whether or not to announce the wedding invitation.
Yes.
Of Barbara, which she knows will irritate Reynolds no end. And there's also just, I suppose, there's a, you call them quite cute, I suppose, exchanges between Reynolds and Alma when they first meet, and there's a kind of movement of the lips and then words and instead just staring contest.
I mean, there are some very good lines. I do like the you know, when Reynolds is irritated by Alma having brought in tea, and he says something like, you know, and then asks her to take it out, which she does, and he's like, you know, the tea is leaving, but the interruption is staying right here with me. You know,
yes.
there are some quotable. Yes, it is quotable, but again, I think it judges it nicely that it holds back from, it doesn't go for. I can imagine an alternate universe world of this film, which went for a more pervasive quotability, and I think this holds back from that in the writing, which I think is very effective. I don't think there's been a great deal of writing on the film. I suppose it's quite recent, but I know it's been well received. So I would be interested to see how the critical reaction to it develops.
Yeah, I was looking around today for articles, doing a bit of research, and it's surprising, actually, a kind of scant amount of. Even, and I was trying to look in trade journals, you know as well, there's no American cinematographer article
right. like
there was for The Master,
right?
Which talked a lot about the kind of large formats and the lenses in great detail.
Mm.
The film's craft is clearly on display, I think, and deserves discussion, as well as some of those broader themes.
Well, maybe people taking time to absorb it, and with luck those things will emerge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, shall we bring things
to a close?
Please like and subscribe to Discursion Podcast. We are on Podbean and also iTunes.